In our study tonight, I want to pick up with verse 17 of Hebrews 11, but before we do that, let's review one more time. I want to be able to identify, by the time we're through with the book of Hebrews, I want to be able to ask you a question regarding what chapter such and such might be found in, and hopefully you can tell me what chapter we've studied that in. But in the first chapter, we find that Christ is described as better than what? Better than the prophets, and also in chapter 1 and chapter 2, he's better than the angels. In chapter 3, he's better than Moses. Chapter 4, we find the let us statements, let us fear, lest we fall short. And then in chapter 4, verse 14, we begin a study of the priesthood of Christ and how that the priesthood of Christ is like that of the Old Testament priesthood of Melchizedek, as we see in chapter 5. The discussion about verse 10. Now, in chapter 5, beginning at verse 11, we have an interruption. What is the interruption about? Maturity. That's right. A state of spiritual maturity. And then picking it up again in chapter 7, we again talk about the priesthood, the comparison of the old and the new priesthood. And then in chapter 8, what are we discussing? Better covenant. That's right. And then in chapter 9, all right, the discussion of the tabernacle, the old and the new, and shows that we have a more perfect tabernacle. In the 10th chapter, what's being discussed? The one. All right, the law is a shadow, and we have one sacrifice, one offering. That's right. Now, in the 11th chapter, it is referred to as the great hall of faith. The hall of faith. Because there we read of great characters of faith, what they did, and of course we've tried to, as we go through, emphasize the action of each character. For example, Abel offered a more excellent sacrifice. Noah prepared an ark. And so we tried to show the relationship between these characters of faith and what they did. They acted upon their faith. And that's essential, I think, for us to see in this chapter. They're not just stated as characters of faith who did nothing, but they acted upon the things that they were instructed to do, and consequently, therefore, they are identified in this chapter of what we refer to as the hall of faith. Now, we've been studying about Abraham. And in verse 17, it says, by faith, Abraham being tried, offered up Isaac. Yea, he that had gladly received the promises was offering up his only begotten son, even he to whom it was said, in Isaac shall thy seed be called, accounting that God is able to raise up even from the dead, from whence he did also in a figure receive him back. By faith, we see that Abraham offered up Isaac. How was it that Abraham was reasoning about the sacrifice of his son, Isaac? What did he believe that God could do? That's right, that God could go ahead and fulfill his promise, even if it meant raising the boy from the dead. He believed that he could do that. Well, that's right. That's right. Joey, and then Randy, do you have a comment?
Yeah.
Okay. Wait for Joey.
Those that would like to take the book of James and tear it out of the Bible, to be consistent, they have to rip out Hebrews chapter 11 as well, because it drives home the exact same point that faith without works is dead.
That's true. That's true. In every one of these illustrations, we see that something was done. Very good. Randy?
I was just going to bring up that Abraham considered that God's able to raise people even from the dead because he had already seen what God.
That's right.
And 100-year-old father.
That's right.
They'd given up hope on having children. And then God said, no, you're going to have a son.
Right. And Romans 4 tells us that his faith wavered not. He believed what God said, that he would have a son in his ripe old age. And so it was. Yes, he had already seen the power of God, had reason to believe in it. So he offered up his son. Someone raised a question, I believe, last time, what kind of a test really was this to Abraham in lieu of the fact that God knew perhaps what he was going to do? And we commented that God did not always choose to know how someone would react, but yes, this was a test. Number one, Abraham had to place obedience to God above his affection, even for this boy. And that was a real test to Abraham, to see where Abraham would land, if he would land on the side of affection for his son or love for God. And we too have to make that decision. In Matthew the 10th chapter and in verse 37, we're to love father, son more, or he that loveth father, mother, son, or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. So we have to make that choice too, to deny those relationships and love those people less than we love God. Abraham had to decide that. And of course, it was a matter of divine promise too. If he believed what God promised, then we can see the reasoning of Abraham here, that he knew that God could fulfill the promise even if it meant raising Isaac from the dead. Abraham believed what God said. Now, in lieu of that, he was able to sacrifice, or willing to sacrifice, I should say, his son upon the altar. In verse 20, it tells us, by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, even concerning things to come. Now, we read in the Old Testament text of the blessing that Isaac pronounced upon Jacob. But what happened concerning Esau? This is in Genesis 27. What happened concerning Esau? Was there anything that Isaac could give to Esau when he gave everything to Jacob? Well, no. But what we do learn is what he gave was things concerning things to come. Whatever that was, the details are simply not given us. We don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us, and I dare not speculate, as to what it was that God said through Isaac unto Esau. But we do know that there was something involving Esau from verse 20. In verse 21, it tells us, by faith Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning upon the top of his staff. That particular verse is especially interesting to me because it tells us that he did two things. He worshipped and he leaned upon his staff. Some translations render that he leaned upon his bed. The spelling of the two words is not altogether that far apart. In fact, I think there's just about one letter difference between bed and staff. But what difference does it make in the long run? He leaned upon his staff. He leaned upon his bed. But the point is, he worshipped and he blessed the sons of Joseph. And what was their names, by the way? Manasseh and Ephraim, that's right. And of course, that takes us back to Genesis chapter 48, where that occurred. Now, when he blessed Ephraim and Manasseh, what did he bless them with? What was the blessing, as it were? Well, things to come, that was to Jacob and Esau. But to Manasseh and Ephraim, what did the blessing that was pronounced upon them indicate? What was it for? Genesis 48. Let's go back and look. That's right. They would share with the rest of his children, so he made them his. He adopted them as his own. And they received an inheritance in the land that was equal to that, in fact, greater than that of his own children. The tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim were greater than the other tribes in size in the portion of land that they received. In fact, if you'll look at verse 3, to Manasseh and Ephraim, Jacob said unto Joseph, God Almighty appeared unto me at Luz in the land of Canaan, and blessed me, and said unto me, Behold, I will make thee fruitful and multiply thee, and I will make thee a company of peoples, and I will give this land to thy seed after thee for an everlasting possession. And now thy two sons, who were born unto thee in the land of Egypt, before I came unto thee into Egypt, are mine, Ephraim and Manasseh, even as Reuben and Simeon shall be mine. Continuing in verse 8, we see the extension of the blessing. Pick it up at verse 14. It says, And Israel, or Jacob as it were, stretched out his right hand and laid it upon Ephraim's head, who was the younger in his left hand upon Manasseh's head, guiding his hands wittingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. What was the significance of putting his right hand upon Ephraim? Greater blessings, that's right. Now, which one was the oldest, Ephraim or Manasseh? Manasseh was the oldest. And so as Manasseh was the oldest and Ephraim receives the greater blessing, much like Jacob and Esau. Esau was the oldest, but Jacob received the blessing. Yes, David?
I was trying to think, was there ever a time that the lineage of Christ was brought down to the oldest? Even the 12 sons of Israel.
Was Judah.
Judah, but he really was the oldest.
Yeah.
So there, Jacob and Esau, this case here,
yeah, the family tree went through. Yeah.
Yeah, David, you know, he wouldn't know.
No. No. I don't know of a time. I'd have to think on that. When somebody says, was there ever a time, I'd have to really think on that a little while. But that's what's taking place in Genesis chapter 48, as we see referred to here in Hebrews chapter 11. Another thought I think that we need to give some thought to in verse 22. It tells us, this is back now in Hebrews 11, verse 22. By faith, Joseph, when his end was nigh, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave commandment concerning his bones. This takes us back to the Old Testament book of Genesis, the last chapter. In fact, the last couple of verses of that chapter. If you'll turn back, if you would please, to Genesis chapter 50 and read beginning at verse 25. It tells us, and Joseph took an oath of the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and ye shall carry up my bones from hence. So Joseph died, being 110 years old. And they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. Bug after me up here. There's a bug after me up here. Joseph reminds them that God will surely visit you and you shall carry up my bones from hence. What is it that Joseph has been made aware of concerning the promises of God? They would leave Egypt and they would inherit. That's right. They would inherit the land promise that God had made unto Abraham, Isaac, and unto Jacob. So Joseph was well aware of this and made mention of that to the children of Israel, and gave commandment concerning his bones. Now in verse 23 of our text, Hebrews 11, verse 23, we begin to read some things about the faith of Moses, and in particular, in this instance, the faith of Moses' parents. It says, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months by his parents, because they saw he was a goodly child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. First of all, what was the king's commandment? Kill all the little boys. That's right. Kill all the little boys. And of course the effort was to accomplish what? What was it he was wanting to do? What was he afraid of?
The Hebrew people were becoming too great, and he was afraid that if there was ever a conflict with another country that they would rise up against Egypt and not help fight.
That's right. And so he's wanting to lessen the crowd, as it were, of the Israelite people. And so he orders that all the little boys be killed. Now, when it tells us that Moses was born and hid 3 months by his parents because they saw that he was a goodly child, we see defiance of the king's order on behalf of the parents of Moses. They are not going to comply. They saw that he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command. And so it was their faith that gave them courage to withstand or to defy the king's commandment. And interestingly enough, tells us that with such a small beginning by faith, they overcame the world of Egypt because they were willing to do this. I think that's fascinating. They were not afraid of the king's command. Now, again, concerning Moses, in verse 24, I want to read down through verse 28. It says, by faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to share ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, accounting the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked unto the recompense of reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, that the destroyer of the firstborn should not touch them. Let's pause there. Number one, by faith, when Moses was grown up, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Moses made a deliberate choice, and it's emphasized in this verse that he was grown up when he made this choice. How old was he? 40. Was 40 years old. Yes, David?
Moses, unlike the movie, Moses knew who his parents were.
Yes.
Because his own mother was his nursemaid.
His own mother was his nursemaid and taught him who he was. That's right. That's right. So Moses chose at an adult age. This tells us that it was not some immature thinking. It was the thinking of a mature individual that chooses deliberately to serve God and to join himself with the people of God. He refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. One of the...
He's using Moses and bringing this out. And of course, the Hebrews that he's writing to, they have this choice that they've got to make. They've got to be looking to the future and to God's promise and stuff instead of going back to the Jewish religion. They've got that choice of choosing Christ over the old and believing in the promise of God's will.
That's right. That's right. They've got the same decision essentially to make that Moses made. Yeah, very good. So he chose rather to share ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. You mentioned that Moses had this choice to make. And these Hebrews, they're going to have to choose the realm of the easy way or the hard way. And, of course, they're called upon to choose the hard way by the example of Moses to identify themselves as the people of God. When Moses refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, what real advantages did he have in Egypt?
He's considered the Pharaoh's nephew.
Pardon me?
That's equivalent to being Pharaoh's nephew. It would have been a great power.
Okay, Pharaoh's grandson, I think. So yes, it would be a position of great power and authority and have all the blessings that Egypt could offer. David?
But in some monarch system, you wouldn't, as a daughter's son, you wouldn't have a lot of authority. But in the Egyptian system, they did, because her brother became Pharaoh, his nephew. He still had, though, under the Egyptian system, he still had some design authority given to him.
Right.
Some monarch systems don't. I mean, you had to be the son and the son of the son. You couldn't, unless there was no other heir. Even if there was another heir in the Egyptian system, they still had authority.
Right. Well, one of the things that I was searching for is the blessings that Egypt could offer as far as education and money and all of those things. Moses had all of that in his hand.
He would definitely have some power, too, under the Egyptian.
Yes, he would. He had all that given to him because of who he was. But choosing rather to share ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. He chose to suffer affliction with the people of God rather than to enjoy sin's temporary pleasures. And that's one of the things that we want to notice in this, the lesson we want to take home with us, is that those things that the world has to offer us are not lasting. Moses understood that. All right. All right.
Not physical one, but and then Christ giving up his home and having it coming to this earth.
Okay, he did.
Quite a bit common there.
There's a contrast to be made and understood. That's right. I think the lesson that Solomon is trying to teach us in the book of Ecclesiastes is to help us to learn that the pleasures of this life are not permanent. He had trouble with that in the beginning of the book of Ecclesiastes and provided everything that his heart could desire. But he found that these were vanity. They were not lasting. They were fleeting. And so consequently, he found at the end of the book that the purpose of man is to fear God and to keep his commandments. That's the whole deal. And Moses understood that. He understood those things and was not willing to continue to be identified as Pharaoh's daughter's child. In verse 26, an interesting passage, one that we want to talk about just a little bit. Accounting the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked unto the recompense of reward. How is it that Moses, so far before Christ came, accounted the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt?
He's still looking at God's promise.
All right.
Which
identifies that Moses was well aware of what God had promised concerning the coming of the Messiah. Now, how much he was aware of that, I don't know, but he had a knowledge of it, much like Abraham did. If we'll open our Bibles to John the 8th chapter and look at verse 56, Abraham had some understanding of the coming of the Christ. As it says, "Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad." Abraham saw something to know that the Christ was coming. So not only did he have it in promise, but he had somewhat of an understanding of what that entailed. So did Moses. He accounted the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked unto the recompense of reward. Looking for a reward, that is, he had confidence in things hoped for, that is, a heavenly reward. The Apostle Paul is a classic illustration. I am so much encouraged by the text of 2 Corinthians 4 and 5 that I keep coming back to that to make this point. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, beginning at verse 16, he says, "Wherefore we faint not, but though our outward man is decaying, yet our inward man is renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is for the moment, worketh for us more and more exceedingly an eternal weight of glory, while we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. For we know that if the earthly house of our tabernacle be dissolved, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens." Moses, like Paul, could see something that God had promised, something, as Paul said, that he couldn't see with the naked eye, but neither could Moses. Moses looked for the recompense of reward. What does the word recompense imply? He looked.
The word compensate inside it, which is something you're receiving.
Okay, something you're receiving for something. Mm-hmm. So Moses has committed himself and committed his life unto God. He expects to see something in return. Now, why could he expect to see something in return? God promised it. That's right. And because God promised it, Paul could see the unseen. Because God promised it. So we want to glean that from this text. In verse 27, Hebrews 11, verse 27, it says, "By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible." Randy, if you would please have ready for me Exodus chapter 2, verse 14. Exodus 2, verse 14. But this text tells us that he was willing to forsake Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. Now, the wrath of the king, we know, may very well have killed him if it had been found out by the king what he did to the Egyptian slave master. You ready there, Randy?
Yep. Exodus 2:14. "But he said, who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" But Moses was afraid and said, "Surely the matter has become known."
All right, who will set the context for that for me? You may.
"Now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, and when he saw there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And he went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other. And he said to the offender, 'Why are you striking your companion?' But he said, 'Who made you a prince or judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?' Then Moses was afraid and said, 'Surely the matter is with him.'"
Moses was afraid. What was he afraid of? All right, that the thing is known, and if it spreads, then he could be killed by Pharaoh. But yet we turn over to this passage, and it tells us, by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. How do we reconcile those two? I don't want to throw you a curve, but I think the two are reconcilable, and reconcilable from the standpoint that whatever Moses was afraid of in Exodus 2, he overcame it. He overcame it. And he came back to Egypt. That's right. So, that's right. Bruce?
So he was actually afraid because he did not be able to fulfill God's promise. That's why he left.
Well, I think he was afraid from the standpoint that this might be found out. These Hebrews know about it, and if they know about it, then it might be known by others. And ultimately, Pharaoh might know about it. And from that standpoint, he could be afraid for his life. But he overcame that. He forsook Egypt and went not fearing the wrath of the king, and endured as seeing him who is invisible. How is it that he saw him who is invisible? Randy?
I just want to step back for a second.
All right.
The New American Standard.
Yeah.
Leaving Egypt, this is not the Exodus?
Don't believe so. I believe this was when he fled, leaving Egypt to go into the land of Midian, where he served as a shepherd for 40 years.
But why can't it only be now instead of the Exodus?
Well, I think the context of it and the order of events from verse 24 or 27 to 28, he hasn't kept the Passover until we get to verse 28. So the Passover was the leaving of Egypt. This would precede the leaving of Egypt, which would probably put it him coming out of Egypt, going into the land of Midian to be a shepherd for 40 years.
Also, that he seen the bush in the natural state of God,
that
he seen what was
unseen. That's right. That's right. He saw the bush burning in the land of Midian.
So that would be the scene he was unseen.
Be one of the instances, yes. Yes. I think seeing the things that are unseen would relate much to what we studied concerning Paul or read in 2 Corinthians 4 and on into the 5th chapter. He saw him who is invisible, but yet we know that he saw the burning bush. He heard God speaking from it, but he didn't see God. He saw what God allowed him to see, in other words. But he's well, yeah, elaborate on that, Bruce.
Because he was in the presence of God.
Yes, but he didn't see God. Yeah. Yes. Okay. That's right. Had to hide the brightness of his face. All right. Good. So he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. He endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover. Now the Passover was what the thing that marked them coming out of the land of Egypt, the death of the firstborn. And he believed in God's warning regarding the death of the firstborn, to the extent that he had Israel to sprinkle the doors and the doorpost with, or the part above the door and the doorpost with, the blood of the lamb. So he, by faith, kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, that the destroyer of the firstborn should not touch them.
That seems to me to be another example of, it would be one thing to think, well, God knows who us Hebrews are, he's just going to save us. But they actually had to perform the act.
They had to do something.
We have to submit to baptism in our day.
Have to do something. That's right. These people would not have been released from the bondage of Egypt if they had not complied with the plan of God pertinent to their being released. They had to observe the Passover. Interestingly enough, about the Passover, let's turn back to that. Exodus chapter 12. In Exodus chapter 12, beginning at verse 24, the text tells us, "And ye shall observe this thing for an ordinance to thee and to thy sons forever. And it shall come to pass, when ye are come to the land which Jehovah will give you, according as he hath promised, that ye shall keep this service. And it shall come to pass, when your children shall say unto you, What mean ye by this service? That ye shall say, It is the sacrifice of Jehovah's Passover, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians and delivered our houses. And the people bowed the head and worshipped. And the children of Israel went and did so as Jehovah had commanded Moses and Aaron, so did they. This was not just something that they were to do to come out of Egypt. It was not something that they were to do simply in order that the death angel, as we refer to him, would pass over their houses. This was also something they did in order that their children might continue to be taught. When their children and children's children would ask, What do you mean by this service? They would use this as an occasion to teach that there was a God in Israel. The Egyptians would know that there is a God in Israel, but the children of Israel would know that there was a God in Israel. In verse 36, yes, go ahead.
One can't help but notice the metaphor there with the original Passover. If you are one of the beneficiaries of the blood covering, you escape death, right?
Right. Right.
In Hebrews, in this area of Hebrews 10 and 11, where we're talking about these types and end times, does it specifically draw that metaphor?
No, not specifically.
Okay.
Not to my knowledge, it doesn't specifically. When you use the word specifically, that kind of shades things.
Yeah, because I mean, the concept is alluded to.
Yes.
Protection of Christ as a result of his blood. But I was wondering if there's a direct passage in the New Testament that talks about the benefits of the blood of Christ mapping directly to the Passover.
Well,
in the New Testament.
Yes. Now, let's answer that anywhere in the New Testament. Yes. And where is it? 2 Corinthians 5 or is it 1 Corinthians 5? That Christ is our Passover? 2 Corinthians 5, I think. It's 1 Corinthians 5? Okay. Yes. Purge ye out the old leaven, that ye may be a new lump, even as ye are unleavened, for our Passover also hath been sacrificed, even Christ. Wherefore let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, neither with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. So
the metaphor is specifically addressed there, but not in Hebrews chapters 9, 10, 11.
Not to my knowledge in those texts. But here it is, specifically referred to as the Passover. Okay. Gary?
Look at that verse and then 29 too. That's an interesting study as you go through the types and the symbolism through. You see very early as Noah, the water symbolizing saving to those that believed and the death of those that didn't. You see it in the Red Sea.
Right.
Saving of those that didn't. So you see those symbols very all through from the very beginning of God's plan, that water with the blood symbolizing those things.
Right.
To believers become salvation. To those that don't believe, they become damnation.
That's right.
And Gary's point is specifically addressed in 1 Peter 3:21.
It is indeed. Yes. It is indeed.
What's odd, if you look at verse 29, and that's to me one of the clearest passages about faith and works that you could use. And that's from the Old Testament even. When the Red Sea was parted, their belief that God had done that for them didn't get them across. They had to walk across that. Their walking didn't part that Red Sea in no way. Calls that saving, but they
right.
had to act. Just believing that it was parted was not good enough.
That's right. They had to act. They had to follow Moses' instructions. Ultimately, they had to follow God's instructions. I'm impressed with the text of Exodus chapter 14, verse 13, when the people are so bewildered, they want to know if there was not enough graves in Egypt that they might be buried there. Why have you brought us out into this wilderness? And Moses said unto them in verse 13, Fear ye not, stand still and see the salvation of Jehovah. Now when they would stand still, I think the implications of that is when you do not know what to do, the best thing to do is do nothing until you find out what is the right thing to do. But when you find out what the right thing to do is, you must act. You must act. And that's what these people did. And so when they were told the right thing to do, in verse 15, Jehovah said unto Moses, Wherefore criest thou unto me, speak unto the children of Israel that they go forward, And lift thou up thy rod, and stretch out thy hand over the sea, and divide it, and the children of Israel shall go into the midst of the sea on dry ground. Now only until they acted upon that were they separated from the Egyptians. They crossed the Red Sea, as we learn in verse 29 of Hebrews 11, on dry ground, and the Egyptians, assaying to do, were swallowed up. They were swallowed up. And so the Israelites would see the Egyptians no more. But in order to enjoy that, they had to do what God said, very simply. Okay? Any other comment or question? All right, look at verse 30. Verse 30 of the text. Another thing that Israel did by faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encompassed about for seven days. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down. And we might raise the question, did the walls of Jericho fall by grace? Yes. They hadn't done anything to earn the city. Did the walls of Jericho fall by faith only? No. They had to work. They had to march around it once each day for 7 days, and then on the seventh day, march around it. 6 days, and the seventh day march around it 7 times, and then blow on the ram's horns, the people shout, and all of that, and the walls would fall. David, and then Joy.
You might notice that it's God's work. That's what God had to do. They didn't do it on their own.
Right.
They didn't go there and make battering rams and knock it down. They did it on the faith of doing what God told them to do.
Right. You know, I read something today. Right.
So it was a work of God. It was not a work of men's own doing.
Right. Joey?
Yeah, and like I said, they were not building catapults. They were following God's instruction, which was to walk around. And by blowing the trumpets and encompassing the city, they were not earning, if you will, the tumbling of the walls. There's nothing they did to earn that. It was still their faith coupled with their works that caused God to follow through.
That's right, and that's what this verse tells us. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell. But yet they had to march around and shout and all of those things in order for the walls to fall. Yes?
One other real quick point. Carolyn earlier was referencing baptism and some of these metaphors we're talking about. And I can't resist the opportunity to make the reference here. As far as the tabernacle and the people within the tabernacle and the things that were outside the tabernacle, notice that the tabernacle, before they entered into the holy place, had to wash in the labor first.
Yes.
And there's a strong symbol there for us because that powerfully, in an illustrative manner, if you will, teaches that you must wash before you go into the holy place. And the metaphor there is you must be baptized before you enter the church. You don't enter the church and then after the fact get baptized. Just like the priest did not go into the tabernacle and then come back out or wash, after the fact. They washed before they came.
That's right. It's interesting to study the place of water in the history of God's plan with man. Water does hold a very valuable place. Okay, it marks a separation. All right. Returning to the thoughts of the city of Jericho, in verse 2 of Joshua chapter 6, we mentioned the question a while ago, did the walls of the city of Jericho fall by grace? In other words, did they have to, or was there something they did to earn the city falling? Well, of course not. In verse 2 it says, "And Jehovah said unto Joshua, See, I have given into thy hand Jericho, and the king thereof, and the mighty men of valor. I have given it into thy hand." But yet, even though the city was given to them, there were conditions attached to their taking of the city. They had to march around it, as we said, and blow the ram's horns and so forth, and the walls would fall. Interestingly enough as well, verse 20 of Joshua chapter 6 tells us that when the people shouted and the priests blew on their ram's horns, the last portion of that verse says that every man went up straight before him and they took the city. They didn't have to hunt for a hole in the wall when they did what God said. When they marched around the city, the walls in its entirety fell down. Now, I was reading some material today that I had to chuckle at, regarding the fall of the city of Jericho. They said actually under the walls there were springs. And the people marching around the city as constantly as they did, and as many people as there were, really activated those springs to the extent that the walls were no longer supported and they fell down. Isn't that something?
Water.
Springs of water.
Not
bed springs, no. No.
Not toothpick.
No. Springs of water. That it, no, 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 no. But the water... yeah, give a modernist a miracle and he'll explain it away.
One of those History Channel shows, it has something for every single plague of Egypt as well. And I've heard that one where, you know, all that trampling just weakens the whole thing. And
yeah, yeah. Makes you wonder why they blew on the ram's horns.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, pardon me?
Let
them know they were there. Well, can you imagine the citizens of the city of Jericho sitting upon the wall looking down at the Israelite army doing this? But by faith, the walls of Jericho fell.
That was the whole point. The citizens of Jericho, when the wall fell, they knew it wasn't the Israelites. They knew it was the Israelites' God.
Well, that's right. And that brings us to this next illustration, Rahab the harlot. Rahab knew the great things that God had done. She had heard of those things. Yes.
You know, every example that the writer brings out, it was their faith that they acted upon, their obedience of what they heard to do. And that's the same thing today. We hear God's word. That's where we get our faith, unto obedience.
That's right.
And if you look at every example here, they were told what they needed to do. They had the faith, but they were told what they had to do to be obedient.
That's right. There were conditions. They acted according to faith when they met the conditions. Now, Rahab the harlot, interestingly enough, as we turn back to the second chapter of the book of Joshua, we learn that this woman took in the two men and hid them. But in verse 8, it tells us, "And before they were laid down, she came up unto them upon the roof, and she said unto them, or unto the men, I know that Jehovah hath given you the land, and that the fear of you is fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how Jehovah dried up the waters of the Red Sea before you when ye came out of Egypt, and what ye did unto the two kings of the Amorites that were beyond Jordan, unto Sihon and Og, whom ye utterly destroyed. And as soon as we had heard it in our hearts, as soon as we had heard it, our hearts did melt, neither did there remain any more spirit in any man because of you. For Jehovah your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now therefore I pray you, swear unto me by Jehovah, since I have dealt kindly with you, that ye also will deal kindly with my father's house, and give me a true token," and etc., etc. But what we learn in these verses is Rahab said, "We've heard of what you've done. We've heard of what the God of your fathers has done through you. We've heard of these things, and we know that you have been given the land, including the city of Jericho." So she didn't have any reason to doubt the things that God said about the city of Jericho. She knew, based on evidence of things that she had heard and seen. I think it's interesting as well that Rahab is specifically referred to here as a harlot. What lesson does that take home with us? Can it not indicate that here is a person that was of bad reputation, if you please, but nonetheless she could change and by faith enjoy the blessings of God as well? Here's a woman that could change her life and worship and serve God and be faithful to Him and receive the blessings of the promises that He had made. So by faith, Rahab hid the spies and was freed from the destruction that came upon the city of Jericho. Beginning at verse 32, Joey?
Doesn't it also send a message that God can use anybody who wants to bring about His will, whether He condones their actions or not?
Yes.
We have other examples where somebody was unacceptable inside of God, but He used them nevertheless to bring about His will.
Well, we have the Corinthians. In 1 Corinthians 6, verses 9 through 11, that we're guilty of a host of things, including homosexuality, fornication in various forms, thieves and robbers, and a whole list of things. But yet they were able to be baptized and to overcome those things. They were washed, justified, and sanctified in the name of Christ. So they enjoyed these blessings in Christ regardless of what they had been. Key here is they had to stop practicing those things. Rahab had to stop the practices of her harlotry in order to enjoy the blessings of God.
She's used here as an example of faith. And in James, she's used as an example of works.
Yes. Yes, good point. Yes, Randy?
I was thinking when you go back and read Joshua 2, you realize that the king was in contact, the king of Jericho was in contact with Rahab too.
All right.
She lied to him and said, well, I don't know what happened to those men. You know, he said, those are men. What it really comes down to is she feared the God of the Israelites more than she feared her king.
That's right. Now what?
She realized that he can do a lot more than he
can. Yeah. And you've got to ask or answer the question, why? Why did she believe that? That's right. She had heard. She had heard. And so because she had heard, she would act. Okay? Well, we'll stop there and start with the listing of the great characters of faith, beginning in verse 32.